lunch, Ennis. Can you all hear back then? I don't want you to miss anything. Why, this meeting here today has been billed as a meeting of reminiscence. A lot of people have been wanting to know some things about the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, how it started, and some of the things that happened. I might say that over these years there's been a good many changes in our fellowship, and I will endeavor to go into some of these things and show you just what has happened over the years and what changes have taken place. Some of them are for the good and some of them are for the no good. But with anything that has growth to it, you have to expect that. Let me start off this way. I am rather a freak in this fellowship. I often mention this, that I came to a fellowship that did not yet exist. That may sound a little confusing or what have you, but here's what happened. During my drinking experience, my family, my wife and all of her brothers and sisters and mother and the whole caboodle, they finally threw me out of my own home for good. And I wound up in New York City, and without a dime in my pocket, and without any clothes, without anything, period. And I only knew one person in New York City, and that was another sister of my wife's. And this guy lived out in Yonkers, and I felt that Virginia would help me because I felt she owed me something. So I made my way out to Yonkers, and I remembered where Virginia lived. I'd been there on my honeymoon, and she lived way up on top of a hill in Yonkers. And instead of getting up on that hill, I went down the hill, and I got into the Italian section down there, and this was in Prohibition days, and all the Italian families made wine. And they were very sociable with their wine. Some of them sold it and some of them gave it away to their friends. And I went down to this neighborhood and I made friends. And by the time I got up to Virginia's house, I was quite a mess. And I can only remember a few details of this visit. I was rolling around on the floor with her two little kids. They were little babies, 3 or 4 years old, little girls. And I was drunk, and I was dirty, and I smelled bad. And Virginia took a dim view of this performance, and she put me to New York, where her brother had thrown me out originally and left me there. I tell this story for a reason. I don't know how long I spent in New York City. It was a long time. But while this was going on, something happened. Later on, Virginia had the doctor over to her home to see about one of the kids, I guess, and they got to talking about drinking. And Virginia related the story of my visit to her home and what a nice guy I used to be and what a dirty, stinking, drunken bum I am now. And this doctor said, "That's odd." He says, "I had a brother-in-law who was a lush, and he was always getting drunk and in trouble. And he has met some strange cult of people. And since he met these strange cults, he no longer drinks. And he runs around New York trying to fix drunks." And he says, "There's another rummy. He's a doctor, a medical doctor down in Akron, Ohio. And he belongs to this strange cult also in Akron, Ohio. And that doctor spends all of his time fixing drunks. And he says if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, maybe he can go down and meet this doctor, and maybe this doctor can fix him." We used to call it fixing. And believe me, we fixed him. It was a lot different. Today they talk about this being a program of attraction, which is the biggest bunch of hot air I have ever heard. I always just want to ask you, who wants to be attracted to a bunch of drunks? There was no attraction there, and this was a terrific sales job. Well, what happened about this doctor in Akron? I eventually came back to Cleveland, and I didn't get in the house, but Dorothy told me about this doctor in Akron and asked me if I'd want to go down and meet him. And I told her I'd be glad to. Nothing else I could do. I had no place else to go. So she put me in the back of her car and took me down to the bus depot, and she bought me a one-way ticket to Akron and put me on the bus with Doc Smith's name and address in my little paw. And that's how I met my sponsor. Eventually, Doc put me in Akron City Hospital. This was long before they had St. Thomas or any of those other hospitals. He used to put his patients in Akron City Hospital. And I was in that hospital for a week. And here are the things that happened to me in that hospital. I was scared to death. I was sick. I had been drunk a long time. I was not a periodic. I was a chronic. There are two types of drunks. There's a periodic and there's a chronic. Those periodics are the birds that give us a bad name. But a fellow like me, a chronic, I'm drunk all the time. I am dependable. I've always had some resentment toward these periodics. They really screw things up, but we don't. People know what to expect of us. Well, anyway, that's a little aside here. I landed in this hospital, and what happened was after a couple of days of shaking it out, I'd been drunk for several years. Now, this wasn't any of this drunk and sober business over several years. I was drunk these several years. And I was unemployable. I was sick. I weighed 130 pounds. And I was broke, and I didn't know where I'd be going when I left that hospital, really. Well, after I was in there a couple of days, the men who had preceded me in this fellowship into which I was about to enter came in to visit me, and they told me the stories of their life, what had happened to them through booze. None of them were sober very long at that time. Doc was sober about a year and a half, and Wilson up in New York, Bill was sober probably a little longer than that. But the fellas in Akron, some of them were just a few weeks and a few months, and a couple of them a year. But they were all older men than I was. All of them were considerably older. I was only 35 years old when I landed in that hospital in February 1938. And these men were all 45, 50, 60 years old. And they'd been through real terrific alcoholic experiences. And they told me about it. And these fellas, they just hit me right. Those fellas, I wanted to belong to that bunch. I wanted to be one of them. They were real 24-karat rummies. And they told me that they had the answer to my drinking problem after they told me their stories. But they never told me what this answer was. And they tell me as they were leaving, they told me they had the answer to my drinking problem. On that note, they'd make their exit. After I was in there a week, Doc used to come in every afternoon to see me and talk to me. And of all the people in that bunch, if I was afraid of anybody, it was really Doc. He had my number. I was scared to death of this man. And I had a great respect for him, but he always frightened me. He frightened me the first time I ever met him. Because I went down there to tell him all about my symptoms. You see, I'm a sick man. And instead of me telling him anything, he took the ball away from me and told me all about myself. And I couldn't figure this out at all. And quite a story in connection with that. And the reason I did fear him so is this. Some years ago in Cleveland, Ohio, there are people here from Cleveland. I see a couple of them in here now. And they'll remember this incident. There was a incident going on in Cleveland they called the Torso Murder Mysteries. There was a hobo jungle down in Kingsbury Run. And a lot of these hobos, this was way back in Prohibition times, and people slept wherever they could. There was an awful depression on at that time. And a bunch of the jugheads used to live down there in Kingsbury Run, down there in the weeds. And they got to finding bodies down there. There were bodies found. Someone was, and these bodies were all cut up, and they were dismembered. And they were wrapped in newspapers. It was a gruesome thing. To my knowledge, recollection, there was at least 7 bodies found. And only one was ever identified through fingerprints. And the newspapers had more fun with this thing than they had with Watergate. Every time they'd find a dismembered body down there, they had headlines. And they were referring to this killer as a mad butcher of Kingsbury Run. And they were trying to figure out, they figured it was either a butcher doing this or a surgeon. Because as they remarked in the paper, this fellow had a fine technique. And he knew something about anatomy. He knew how to cut things up. He did a masterful job. So he was a professional man of some kind. And they thought perhaps he was a surgeon going wacky and getting his jollies out of doing things like that. So this thing was going on. And when I met my sponsor, Doc Smith, Dr. Bob as people call him, one of the things that after he told me all about myself, I got thinking, holy smokes, this guy, something's wrong here somewhere. How does he know all this, see? And then the crusher came when he made the remark that he wanted to put me out in a goonie roost out here in Cuyahoga Falls where nobody could get at me. And it came through to me that I had met the mad butcher. He's been following me around, and now he is ready to do his little thing. And that goonie roost business where nobody could get at me killed it. Because about that time, I wanted everybody to get at me. And I waited my opportunity. I up and ran out of that man's office. He had 3 different doors I had to go through to get out. I never stopped for any elevators. I went down those 7 floors and gone. That was my first meeting with my sponsor. So you can see why I feared this man. Later on, I had to go back to see him. I had no other thing to do. I was lying around with these jugheads one day, and we got to talking about quitting drinking. I think I instituted this conversation. And I can still remember, here's what drove me into this fellowship. We come from all directions. That chap last night talking about we all come to some extremity, we come to an end. I come to mine, and as proven by this one statement I can make. We were lying around there talking about quitting drinking, and this flannel mouth Irishman, everybody's drunk there, you want to remember, there's no sober ones around. Some of them are passed out, other ones are up and around. But this Irishman, he says to me, "You quit drinking." He says, "You'll never quit drinking." He says, "You don't have guts enough to quit drinking." He says, "Look at you." I says, "I'm going to quit drinking." He says, "You don't have guts enough." He says, "You know, to quit drinking takes determination." And he says, "To have determination, you need a chin." He says, "You got a chin like Andy Grump. You're no damn good." Well, you know, that man goaded me to the extent that what little bit of left in me, what little spark I had left, I had to make the bet good. I said, "I'm going to quit. I know a doctor Akron can fix me." He says, "Nobody can fix you. You're no damn good." I said, "I'll show you." He said, "You show me." And do you know that I got a hold of someone's telephone? I don't know whose phone, because we didn't have those facilities where we were. And Doc told me, I called him numerous times. I only remember calling him once, and he told me to meet him in City Hospital the next day in Akron, Ohio, the next morning, and I was there, and he put me in the hospital. That's how I started. Then I met these men. And the day that we left the hospital, the night we left the hospital, Doc took me to a meeting of the Oxford Movement in Akron, Ohio. I didn't know what it was. I knew there was an awful lot of people there. And I saw these rummies there who had visited me in the hospital. And I knew these people, these fellows, but the rest of these people I didn't know. And there were a lot of ladies there, a lot of women. And they kind of scared me a bit. I'm glad over the years I've gotten over that. Making up for it. But I didn't know what I was into, and I watched the format of these meetings, and I couldn't catch on what was going on much at all. As the weeks went by, I finally got through to me that I belonged to the Oxford movement. And that's where AA was born, is in the Oxford group. Doc Smith had been in the Oxford group before he ever met Bill Wilson, but he never stayed sober. Bill Wilson was brought into the Oxford movement by Abby Thatcher in New York at Calvary House. And that's where Bill got his start. So Bill was meeting with Oxford group people as well. And whatever rummies he picked up along the way, they were attending Oxford group in New York. Then something else happened. I want to show you what happens to the development of this fellowship. Something had to happen. I thought, you know, that my sponsor told me I'd have to spend the rest of my life fixing drunks as an avocation, not a profession, as an avocation. I was supposed to go out and make my own living some way and fix drunks along the way. And first things first, the drunks were to be fixed first. I'd always, if I depended on God, I'd always find a way to eat. And this is so true. I didn't have anything to offer an employer. And I had to eat. My wife let me come back home for a while, and I was one of these unfortunate people that the marriage didn't work out after I got sober for too long. I got back home, and boy, I got busy AA and her chasing drugs all over the creation and spending all my time chasing them. And Dorothy had always been accustomed to being the social secretary of the family, taking care of those matters. And everyone coming to the house used to be coming looking for her. They weren't looking for me. And this situation changed. And I started chasing all over, making contacts where I could find rummies. These people were coming to the house looking for me, and some of them were pretty important people. And she just couldn't take this. She couldn't get with it. And I don't blame her, because after all, I had been drunk so long, she'd had to run everything. So finally she said to me, "This is worse than when you were drinking. We better try this apart again." So she packed my little suitcase and away I went, and I never did go back. But that's just what happened. That's happened to some people in this fellowship. The marriage don't work out after you're sober. But I suppose every case is different, but that was mine anyway. Well, I had to go out and fend for myself and find a place to live and something to do, and I did. I lived in a cheap boarding house down on Euclid Avenue. I paid $20 a week room and board in this boarding house, and I got two meals a day and one on Sunday. So I had a few meals I had to buy on the outside, and I had clothes to buy and other things, and on $20 a week, whatever I had left, I used to squander on women. It was some deal. But let me tell you, that boarding house had some stories to it. To talk about what happened there, I was living there, and there were probably a half a dozen other rummies living there, sober ones. Then there was a lot of other people. There were about 35 people living there. We used to always eat together in the basement. We had a big table in the basement. That is a kitchen and the dining room combined. So we ate at certain hours there, certain hours for breakfast, certain hours for supper. And if we were good and we didn't start any fires in the place or anything like that, every once in a while the old Irish landlady would let us bring a guest to dinner. It would cost us 50 cents to do that. I tell you this for another reason. I invited a guest one night. I was going with a gal, and I wanted her to come over sometime to this boarding house and meet some of these inmates and see where I was living and how I was living and all about it. And I paid my 50 cents to get her meal. We which was a big investment for me at the time. And there'd been a fella came along there, and now let me tell you about this fella. I want to tell you about some miracles that happened. The lad came into that rooming house one day. I happened to be there when he came in. He was all dressed up, handsome fella, wonderful looking chap. He didn't have a hair out of place on his head. He was wearing a Art Chapman Mark suit, and he looked stood out like a sore thumb in that bunch of inmates where I was staying. But he moved in there, and why? You'll have to give me the answer to this one. He was a salesman as it developed, and salesmen don't come out and live in cheap boarding houses in cities. They stay in a downtown hotel where they can show their merchandise and call on the stores that they're working with. But he came into that place way out there, 87th and Euclid Avenue, and walked into that boarding house where I was living and a half a dozen other fellas, as I was, rummies. This fella had been up in Detroit at the Book Cadillac Hotel, and he got talking to the assistant manager. He had an alcoholic problem, and this assistant manager says, "Say, do you know there's a bunch of guys down in Cleveland, Ohio, that have some way of fixing drunks?" He says, "You go down there, maybe they can do something for you." Now this fellow knew nothing about Cleveland, Ohio, outside of the hotels downtown and that. And this fella came to Cleveland, and instead of staying at one of the downtown hotels, he walks right smack dab into that boarding house where I live. Now this fella's name, and you'll recognize this fella, was Willis Kilgore. Willis Kilgore was a guy that the first rummy that ever sobered up for the Atlanta area. I noticed old Willis when he moved in, but I was too busy with rummies to pay attention to this bird. He was too handsome for me. And a day or so later, two or three, 4 days, I noticed Willis's hair was not combed. He still has the same shirt he had on when he moved in. He hasn't shaved, and he smells awfully bad. And this goes on for about a week, and by this time, he's a total disaster. He's practically a basket case. So I had invited this girlfriend of mine to supper that one night, and I brought her in there, and I introduced her to some of these birds, and all of a sudden, here comes this apparition in through the door. It's Willis, and he is the bloodiest mess you have ever seen. And where does he sit? He punks himself right across the table from my gal friend, who I'm trying to make time with, and myself. And boy, I hit the ceiling, see? I said, "Boy, oh boy, oh boy, I'll kill that guy, you know." And this gal says, "No, Clarence, you can't do anything like that. You gotta fix him." So this is a good way to take care of a resentment. So I'm on the spot, so I take old Willis out of there, take him up to his room, and I find out that he has two or three other Art Chapman Mark suits with him. He's all set for clothes. The clothes he has on are awfully filthy, but he has plenty of clothes. He hasn't got a nickel left in his pocket. I tapped him out for money, and nothing there, nothing. So I found out he's from Atlanta. And his folks there were pretty well to do. They owned a lumber company and a toy factory. He used to sell these little paddles with a rubber ball on them, you know, and with that elastic on it. And he was a marvelous using that paddle. So he was selling that thing and some of the other wooden toys. And the mother answered the phone at home. He gave me the mother's phone number, and she was glad to hear from him. I know that somebody had him in tow. Apparently old Willis used to do this every once in a while. And so over the telephone, I called her collect, incidentally. And out of this, where I asked her to send $50, and I put Willis in a dry-out place and get him sober. So she wired me the money, and I put Willis in Post Shaker Sanitarium. Now, there is a miracle. How did that man ever... He had no knowledge of where I was. He didn't know me. He'd never heard of me or any of these fellas. Some fella in the hotel up there told there was some fellas in Cleveland that had a way of fixing drunks. And he walks right smack dab into where I live. How do you answer that? He answered the same way, answer the way that I got into this fellowship. When Virginia had this doctor over, this doctor's name was Leonard Strong, and he happened to be Bill Wilson's brother-in-law in New York. And the doctor, he's talking about a Doc Smith down in Akron. Here I am getting involved in the two main honchos of this deal, and I'm all innocent of the whole thing, see? Now Willis walks in down here and walks into my house. That's just one guy that these miracles happen. Let me tell you some other miracles. Let me tell you something about this fellow that Ennis mentioned, this ex-delegate, and he was one time with the editor of our grapevine, right? Right. Let me tell you about him. I want to talk to you about miracles and things that happen. Early in our experience in Cleveland, we got a lot of terrific, good newspaper publicity. In 1939, we got this publicity, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of inquiries came in. And I got all the inquiries. In our publicity in the paper, we had a post office box in Cleveland. We had to put in a telephone answering service. And we had a post office box in New York, and they all appeared in our publicity. Some of the inquiries would go to New York, they'd send them to me. All the ones at the Cleveland Plainer would get, I'd get. And all that Dilworth Lupton, the minister who preached a sermon about this, got, I got. We had a limited number of people, men in AA at the time. I'd give each one a handful of them on Monday morning and tell them to go out and call on these and report to me by Wednesday evening what they had done, just like a sales manager does. You give them prospects and send them out. And don't you know, all of these people did this, and they didn't think there was anything wrong with this idea. Today, people will call up some of these clubs, and hell, nobody will go out and see them. They'll find out 40, 11 reasons why they shouldn't. Let them come down here, let them call, let them do this, let them do that. This is strictly a promotion. I want you to know this. If this were not promoted, you wouldn't have an AA today. And I'll prove this to you. And another thing, when they talk about anonymity, they don't know what they're talking about either. This is another thing that gripes me. Some of these donkeys are trying to make a secret society out of this AA. They don't even want to tell you their name. My God, these are our friends. It's the first thing I want to know who my friends are. It's hard sometimes to tell. No, we never worried about this. Let me tell you what anonymity means to me. I've gotten in more damn trouble with some of these birds about anonymity. And here's all it means to me. What I want to do with my anonymity, that's my business. If I want to get out here on the public square and make a speech and tell everybody I'm a rummy, that's my business, strictly. That's nobody else's. But I have no right to go out and tell them that Joe Blow belongs to AA without Joe Blow's permission. Now, there's a lot of Joe Blows that don't care. They'll give me permission if I need it. That's what anonymity means to me. I'll protect yours. But some people need that. Most of us don't. You know, people, there's been this element of fear that has been brought into AA. I told you there's some things good that come in, some things that stink. And we have an element of fear pervading AA in a lot of places. People are, and this thing of anonymity that's miscalled is a matter of fear. And we shouldn't fear anything. You and I shouldn't. People say, geez, if they find out, I'll lose my job, or I won't get a job if they know I'm an alcoholic. Did it ever occur to you that if you want a good job, don't you think that company's going to check you out? And don't you think they have plenty of ways of checking you out now, today, with all these computers and everything? I worked for an insurance company since I've been sober. I worked for them for 11 years. And I was way over age to go to work for an insurance company when they hired me. And do you think that they didn't know that I'm a rummy? I told them I was. An insurance company knows more about you than your own mother does. Really. You can't kid those people. They've got cards on everyone. They know when you had your last cold. I kid you not. I went through this department of ours in that big life insurance company I worked for, and they have all those computers and all this stuff, and they have millions and millions of cards in there. Anybody who has ever applied for insurance of any kind or been in any kind of trouble of any kind of divorces, they've got records on you. People don't realize what records that people have on us. And if they want to run a check on you is for moral purposes, you're just kidding yourself when you go out and tell those people or try to hide something from them, because you're not going to hide it from them. They know. So I have never gone and gotten a job with anyone that I hadn't told them that I'm a rummy. If they don't like that, I don't need their damn job, because I'm going to be busy sometime. I'm going to have some time off. And they're going to have to understand that. Just for an example, Grace and I just came back from a three-month trip around the country. What started this trip? I don't go on 3 months business trips. I go on 3 week business trips. But 3 months, this is ridiculous. I had commitments to speak at AA groups around the country. So I had the company to schedule me in those areas. Isn't that great? Go around and work your way around and enjoy yourself and go to AA and the whole thing. The company does it. They know I'm a rummy. They know all about it. They know why I wanted it. They know I'm here. They know where I'm at all the time. They don't. And they're a big outfit. They're a very, very progressive company. They're glad that I'm a rummy that's not drinking anymore. I worked for a steel company one time for several years in personnel work. I had to take care of all the birds that got drunk in that steel company. They knew I'm a rummy, so they turned them over to me. When I went into the lodge and the order, nobody in Cleveland ever, if a fella had any alcoholic experience or black marks on them, they always called me, no matter what lodge it was in the town, and they get my opinion of the guy. How do you like that? How are we going to hide things like this from people? I just want people to overcome fears of these things. I realize that if a fellow is a doctor or a surgeon, you don't want everybody to know he's a lush, because the general public has still maintains some very odd feelings about rummies, and they don't want any drunken doctor cutting them up. So I can understand that. But most of this doesn't mean a thing. Let's not fear anything. We come down here and turn our world, our life over the care of God. We don't have to fear anything. How can we be full of fear? You and I are supposed to live on faith. Let me talk about some of these people. How did AA start? This is something a lot of people don't know. I told you I went to this Oxford group meeting in Akron, Ohio. I went there 15 months. I attended Oxford group meetings for 15 months. And in that length of time, I was chasing around all over Cleveland and Cuyahoga County trying to get some drunk fixed. And believe me, there was no scarcity of them, but I couldn't sell the idea to any of them. Remember, there was nothing set up in those days. We had no book, there was no AA, there was nothing like that. I went around where these rummies were, and I would try to convince them they ought to quit drinking and be like me. And they didn't want to be like me, unfortunately. I talked to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rummies before I ever got my first one in the hospital. It took me 7 months, 7 long months. And the first fellow I got was a Polish fellow. He had been an auditor for Sherwin-Williams Paint Company in Cleveland for 30 years and been fired for being drunk and lost his family and a whole bit. And he was on the bum, and he was existing, with a bunch of other jugheads in an abandoned house over on Fleet Street in Cleveland, Fleet Avenue. those Depression days, people used to just move out of their houses and leave them. And these rummies would move in. It's better than sleeping under bridges, you know. They just take squatters' rights. This was a, these are desperate times. And Bill Hess was lying there in one of those, on the living room floor of one of those houses. That's where I found him. I have never seen a fella in his type of condition before. He was drunk, paralyzed drunk. He couldn't get off of that floor, but he knew everything that was going on. He could talk to me and understand what I'm saying, but he couldn't move. He couldn't move a muscle. He was just black, like he was glued to that floor. He was a big man. I talked to Bill about quitting drinking. I got right down on the floor with him, you know. And Bill was all for it. So I asked him the foolish question, whether he had any money, whether he could get a hold of 50 bucks. Of course not. But he had a mother out in Madison, Ohio, which is 50 miles east of Cleveland. And he said his mother, if I went out and met her, she could probably raise the 50 to get him in a hospital. I borrowed an automobile and went out to Madison, Ohio, and I found that farm where this little old lady was living. And I went up through this long lane to the home. And boy, I got my next jolt up there. This little old lady came to the door, and as I say, door was Polish. And his mother was very Polish. She knew nothing about English, and I knew two words in the Polish language, Jakshaman Dubche. That's all I know. Well, how much can you Jakshaman Dubche in a place, you know? So she got a little grandson about 7 years old as an interpreter, and through this kid, I sold this old lady the idea of giving me 50 bucks so I could fix her boy. And she went back there and cut a lump out of the mattress and gave me these 50 big dollar bills, and I was the happiest man in the world. I headed back for Cleveland. I called Doc and told him I was coming with a rummy. You know, I thought if I ever sponsored one guy, I'd really be a member. I never thought I'd really belong until I'd done something like that. And with all that enthusiasm, that's why I talked to these hundreds of rummies. Well, I went out, went back to Fleet Avenue, and Bill's still lying in the same damn place he was when I left that morning. And I got a couple of these other jugheads to help me, put him in the back of the car, and away we went for Akron and down to the hospital. That was my first baby. I know now why it took me 7 long months to get that first rummy. As you heard it read here in this fifth chapter, says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. I just didn't have a message up to that time. Apparently, I finally got the message that I could deliver. Because after that, they start coming in quite fast after that. Do you know this? Now, there's a girl sitting right over here. Her husband, he used to call me his grandfather in AA, because I sponsored his sponsor, right? Old George McDermott. These people are all dead now, but I started going after rummies with a vengeance then, now that I'd scored. You know how sales are that. You feel blood. You taste that blood. And the first thing you know, we had a dozen rummies going down to Akron from Cleveland. And a strange thing about it, 8 of these fellas were Catholics. Now, they had no Catholics in the Oxford group. A Catholic could not belong to the Oxford group. It was a Protestant deal, and they wouldn't keep the Catholics out, but the Catholic Church kept them out. They could not accept the premises and the things in the different fall that all the Oxford group went through. So I told all these fellas that this would not interfere, this plan would not interfere with their religion if they had any. But I lied to them. I didn't do this knowingly. It was all in ignorance. But they went down there to Akron and they watched this performance. and they look at this leader and what he's doing, what the rest of the people are doing and saying, and what's going on, and they look at each other, look at me. And I just getting static all the way back to Cleveland, so we had to do something. So I went down to talk to my sponsor, Doc, the only smart thing I knew to do. And I told him what our situation was. He says, well, he says, we're not keeping them out of the Oxford group. They're welcome. He says, no, you're not keeping them out, but their church keeps them out, which is just all the same thing. He says, well, that's their problem. I said, no, Doc, it's not their problem. It's our problem. He says, what do you mean it's our problem? I said, well, I says, after all, we have now written a book. The book was written in the fall of 1938. And this was in May of 1939 that I'm doing all this squawking to my sponsor. See, I'm sober 15 months. I know everything by now. I'm telling my sponsor how to do it. Well, anyway, I happen to have been correct on that at that time anyway. I didn't make the mistake. But anyway, Doc says, you can't do that. I says, why not? He says, well, we owe our lives to these people. We give to the Oxford group. We can't split out of here and bust this thing up. I says, well, we'll have to do it. He says, you can't do it. I says, oh, we can. At that time, Al Goldrick, you know Al, he was in the hospital. I'd worked all winter on Al. And I never could get that guy to go down to Akron, that hospital. I go pull him out of saloons and take him home and all this kind of stuff. And Bill Wilson came over to visit me one time. And I was just leaving to go out to see Al that night. I said to Bill, come with me. We'll talk on the way. I got to see this guy tonight. He's about ready to crumble. We used to work on him and overpower him, really, any way we could get him. So Bill didn't want to go, but he did. He finally said, okay, so he went out. And it was a good thing he did, because Bill said something to this guy that pushed him over, and he agreed to go to the hospital the next day. So I didn't even drive him. Bill and Dorothy took him down to the hospital the next day, and he was down. He was in the hospital, and all this was going on between Doc and myself. Al was in there at the same time Wally Hemsley, the ball player, was in. So I went out to see Grace, his wife, about using their house for a meeting place. They had a big home up on the Heights, beautiful home, plenty of room. Al was losing the house at the time, but he still had it. And he was getting kicked out of his law firm at the time, but he was still there. And I talked to Grace about having meetings, and she was delighted at the idea of having a meeting in her home. So, went down to Akron the next week and made the announcement this is the last time the Cleveland contingent will be down here as a group. We're starting our own group in Cleveland, Ohio. Now listen to this. And this is not going to be known as an Oxford group. This is going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking the name from the book. And only alcoholics and their families are welcome. Bingo. Well, you know what happened? The roof came off the house. Fred, you can't do this. It's been done. You want to come down and talk about it. There's nothing to talk about. It's done. There was an awful riot going on. I always say, hey, it was born in a riot and it grows in riots. We never grow peacefully. There's always a riot. And it started way back there in 1939. So I thought we had a problem and a riot in Akron. And at night, I wish you'd have seen next Thursday night up in at Al Goldrick's house on Cleveland Heights. I had made the mistake of telling these people the address. I told them it was going to be at 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights. And don't you know that whole caboodle, that whole lot. Sylvia was a patient in there, and she was in dreadful shape, pills and booze. And she, don't you know that this sister-in-law of mine sent Sylvia to Cleveland to see me. And I'm telling you, this girl was a real spook. She was so pilled up, she walked through doors without opening them, you know. She was there for 3 weeks, and all I had to do was keep following her around to watch that she didn't bring the place down. But Sylvia came to Cleveland, and she went back to Chicago. Earl Treat had been in the Oxford group in Akron when I was, and his business took him to Chicago. But he never did one blooming thing about 12-step work when he went to Chicago until Sylvia got there. And boy, she lit the candle under that boy. And that's how Chicago started, was through Sylvia that pillhead, that drunken gal that came and stayed 3 weeks. She went and woke up Earl, and that's the way they started the Chicago group. Al Stegman, let me tell you about Al, this fellow that was the ex-trustee, or he's been, and he was also the editor of the Grapevine. When things started to go so fast in Cleveland with this publicity, we just couldn't bring them in man-to-man, eyeball-to-eyeball anymore. There was just too many people coming. We didn't have enough people to absorb them that way, so we had to absorb them in classes. So we were looking around for places where we could meet, and I was desperately looking for a place where we could train rummies, you know, like you train them in a zoo, maybe. Just run a school for them, really, is what amounted to. So I used to chase out on these inquiries, too, and then at night I'd come home and write correspondence courses on AA all over the country. No kidding. I tell you the fact, I bet I didn't get 3 or 4 hours sleep a night for the first couple of months after that publicity came out, because people would cut these articles out and send them out here to Aunt Ida out here in Wyoming someplace, and because Uncle Slug was drunk, you know. And I was getting inquiries from all over the country. I was answering them in longhand, and my writing is terrible. But it worked. But I was also chasing down these things. So I had one day. This fellow's name happened to be Walter Beilstein. Well, that name sounded a little familiar to me. It kind of rang a bell that I couldn't place it. But I went out on it. And here I got out there. It was in a declining neighborhood, what they call Little Hollywood now. And they had been millionaires' homes there, these great big 24-room houses, you know, with the servants' quarters in the back and all that, and the carriage houses back there. Big house. So we're here to the Beilsteins with a funeral home. They'd taken this big house and made a funeral home out of it. So I charged up on the porch and asked for Walter Beilstein. The fellow answered the door. He said, Walter. I said, yeah, Walter Beilstein. Oh, he said, Walter. Walter. See? So I know I'm in the right place. So he says, Walter lives back here in the carriage house upstairs. You'll find him up there. He developed that Walter was a remittance man. They paid him to stay the hell out of a funeral home. He stayed up there. So we had that whole entire upstairs of this enormous carriage house. And Walter, he came to the door when I got up there and rapped, and he appeared with a little beret on, you know. And Walter was very affable, very sociable, and very drunk. And he had his beret on, and I looked at that, and fellas with berets in those days were not looked upon with the same enthusiasm they are today. And he invited me in. And I went in and thought, my heavens to Betsy, here is the answer to our prayer. Here is our meeting hall where we're going to train rummies. Here's our training place. Walter lived in one end of this place. He had his four burner cook stove and his oven and his shower bath and all this stuff and his bed in one end. And the entire rest of this stuff was a theater. Walter was interested in amateur theatricals, and he used to put on little amateur shows up there, and he bought a couple hundred picture show seats from some show that had gone out of business or something, and he had them all fixed to the floor there. And it was a regular theater. It had a big stage up there and all these drops and props and the whole bit, see? And I looked at that thing, and I said, my God, that God is good to us. Here is our meeting hall. So I said to Walter, I said, you are a gift from heaven. She says, I am? I said, yeah. So, knowing Walter is a ham, I said, Walter, all those seats out there, we're going to fill them every night. How about that? He says, we are? Said, yeah. Okay. So, we had our training meetings up there, and I tell you, this was something. But you want to remember, that was a depression time, and a lot of people were out of work. A lot of people had nothing to do with their time anyway. And so everyone, all these fellas would come up there, and they wouldn't wait for any 8 o'clock deal. They were starting to come up there around 6, 7 o'clock and filling up the place, see? Both Whitwell, Clarence Whitwell, myself, and a couple of the guys, we'd get up there and blat at these fellows for hours, you see, at night. And they'd come back. And it was bad weather, and everything good happens in bad weather up there. They'd come up there, and they'd fill that place. And one night I got the idea that, geez, you know, these guys aren't eating too regularly. We got a cook stove back here. So I made an announcement. I got up one night and said, hey, how'd you guys like to have a meal up here every night when you come up? A supper. Well, this was great. I said, you got to bring something. Bring your own stuff and throw it all in the pot and we'll have something to eat every night. Well, this was great. So every night those birds come up those stairs, and I never saw anybody carrying anything out like this. It's always under their coat. Now, nobody asked questions. This is, of course, you read in the Bible in the Moses time about the manna that dropped from heaven. Well, this is similar. So anyway, we ate every night. We just took over Walter's place. Well, all these men coming up there night after night, let me tell you about this. These fellows coming up there night after night listening to us blat out about this AA, give them all we could. They were staying sober, this bunch. They were. Believe me, they found something new. They were enthused. So finally the police came up. The police came up twice. They had reports from the neighborhood. There's something odd going on in the back of Balstein Funeral Home. So the police came up to investigate. And of course, when they walked in and saw these 100 or so men, a lot of them they knew. They'd been their customers. They'd been with them at a wagon and back and forth. And they were flabbergasted. They looked at these fellows. There's nothing wrong. They're not drunk. They're not doing anything out of the way. There's no gambling. Nothing going on up there. They had a lot of grub up there and coffee and one thing and another. So the cops had no argument with us. Then the neighbors start coming up. So one night a little old lady come pounding up those stairs. And she wants to know. She's been living down the street a few doors. And she wants to know what's going on up there. There's something vile going on in this neighborhood. And she wants to know all about it. So I invite her in and I show her and tell her what we're doing. And she's flabbergasted because she sees a bunch of the jugheads in there that she used to sweep off her porch and her lawn in the morning, you know, they'd be drunk on her porch and that. And she just couldn't get over it. So she still feels all sober. Yeah. She says, yeah, we fix them. That's what they're up there for. She says, you can fix all these drunks? We fix all of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We never believe that anybody could fail. This, I think, is one of her secrets. So she looks at me, she says, you know, she says, I have a boy in New York. I don't know where he is. He's on the bum up there. Could you fix him? I said, sure, we can fix him. She says, well, how are you going to do it? I says, well, we have people up in New York to fix him. So she says, well, who are they? Let me know. So she would have none of this stuff of waiting for anything. So I gave her Bill Wilson's name and address. That old lady was on the first Rattler going up to New York the next day, and she digs up Bill. And Bill sent some guys down in the highways and the byways, and they found this bird, her son, see? And they put him in the group up there, and he's been sober ever since. He's living with us down in Florida here now. Now, how about that? What would you call that? That little old lady coming up in that house in her own neighborhood, and her son's out there in New York somewhere, doesn't even know where. And through that visitor, hers up there, to her curiosity, he lands in AA, and he's been sober for 30-some years now, and doing a great job. There's another one of these miracles. Well, Archie Trowbridge, I talked to some people today from Detroit. They mentioned Archie. Archie Trowbridge, he didn't weigh 80 pounds soaking wet when he was in his best of health. Really. Archie belonged to a very wealthy family in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. He showed me his wedding pictures with the top hat and the whole bit, you know. But the family had thrown him out and disowned him. And the people in the Oxford movement in Detroit sent him to Akron, to the Oxford group people, to see if they couldn't do something with Archie. He was a rummy. And Archie moved in to live with Doc Smith. And Archie's story is in the book, The Fearful One.
Archie was so full of fear that you couldn't get that guy to cross the street. When he lived with Doc, he'd go right up to the corner of the street, but you couldn't get him off that curbstone. He had a phobia about that. He was scared of that. He wouldn't cross the street. And this was his condition. He was a really racked out, this fella. Terrible. And he lived there with Doc. He stayed sometimes with Clarissa and T. Henry Williams, the people that run the Oxford group. Then he'd be back at Doc's. One night I took a rummy down to Akron. Took George McDermott down to Akron. Put him in the hospital. I'd worked with George a long time, and George was a sales manager for a brick company up in Cleveland. And I had a hard time convincing George that he ought to belong to this fellowship. But George got himself convinced one time. He went to a hockey game up there, and he got drunk, and got smart with a lot of guys, and he got the hell beat out of him. And this was all the trouble he needed. And he decided to go down to Akron. So I took George down to Akron this night, and I had to take his wife along, and you know her. I had more damn trouble with her than I ever had with George. I asked her, first of all, if she had any booze in the house, and she said, "What do you want booze for?" I said, "I gotta give George a drink once in a while on the way down." She was against that, but she finally brought it. Every time I give George a belt going down there, she'd give me a belt. Had more trouble with her. Finally got George down there, and I thought about driving home with this babe. She was something else, and she was not my type. Not at all. And, well, you know her, you don't understand that. Well, anyway, I thought of Archie over at Doc's. So I swung around by Doc's house, and Annie was home. Doc was out gone, so he was still at the hospital. And I says, "Archie, I've got so much to do. I'm overwhelmed. I'm up to my ears with rummies. I need help. Will you come up and help me?" And Archie looked at me like I had thrown a bomb at him. Nobody in the world had ever asked Archie to do anything. No. And he was so scared of everything, he was stunned when I asked him if he'd come up and help me. And he stood there with his mouth open, and he says, "Go up, get your sweater, you're hurting, you hurt Cranston, go up and get your sweater and go with him." And she's glad to get rid of him. And I took old Archie with me back to Cleveland. And he got so damn busy up there with rummies, he didn't know there were curbstones anymore. And this is what brought Archie through. He went back up to Detroit and started the Detroit group. A little old guy, didn't weigh 80 pounds. We had another fellow. One day, the editor of the Cleveland Press, Louis Seltzer, you knew Louis Seltzer, he called me and he said he had a fellow, the newspaper man, a good man, he's worth saving if we could find him. He says, "We'll pay any expense that's involved in it if you can find him. We think this man's worth salvaging." So I sent a couple guys down around Bolivar Road, and they found this fellow, Larry Jewell. And this fellow, believe it or not, he was more dead than alive, Larry was. He had one collapsed lung and he had a tube sticking out of the other one. And he was lying in an abandoned warehouse there in the middle of winter, cold, freezing, and that man's in that condition. He didn't weigh much over 100 himself either. He was in terrible condition physically. These boys found him, they called him, and they said, "Well, bring him out to Post Shaker," so I met him out there. And they brought him in the Post Shaker Sanitarium that we were using. They made arrangements with these people at Post Shaker to take rummies. They had been handling state cases, mental cases, and the state had just built a new mental institution outside of Cleveland. So they were taking all the patients away from Post Shaker. So Post looked like they were going broke. They needed business. And we just hit at the right time. This was a great thing for us and a great thing for them. I went out and made a deal with Post Shaker Sanitarium. For $40 a week, we put rummies in there. Well, they were only getting $21 a week from the state for mental patients, and those mental patients ate three times a day, and rummies don't eat that much when they go out there. They had all the facilities there. They had it's a wonderful place for them, the old Licey Estate, the old Licey Brewing Company Estate. And so they brought Larry Jewell in, and Mrs. Post says, "No, we won't take that guy." I said, "What do you mean you won't take that guy? You take all the guys we bring in here. Not him. Everybody but him." it seemed that Larry, during his escapades, had married one of her nieces and had just ruined her life. And she would have no part of him. I said, "Oh," I said, "listen, Mrs. Post, you take this guy or you take nobody anymore. We're at the end of the story." So she took him. He was in there. Larry stayed in there for, I think, about 4 weeks. He was in frightful condition. And Louis Seltzer and his friends paid the bills, and they gave Larry the option of going any place in the country that he wanted to live. Cleveland was no place for a man in his condition. They thought maybe he'd go to Arizona or California, Florida or something. But somehow or other, Larry chose to go to Houston, Texas. And on the way to Houston on the train, Larry got thinking about this, and he started writing a series of articles similar to the ones that Alderick Davis had written in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And he took them to the Scripps Howard paper in Houston and stole them, these articles. And that's how AA started in Texas. There's a fellow who should be dead, and he's the guy that started that whole thing in Texas. So from Larry Jewell, the whole activity in Texas started. I can go on and tell you about how this thing spread through people that came in those days. We had a fellow, a Jew, Irv Meyerson. Irv Meyerson was a great big heavyset fellow. He's a salesman. He traveled all over the country. He sold imitation shutters, you know, these shades you put over the windows. And he had them made out of cardboard, and they were supposed to be made out of plastic. He sold this crap all over the country. And Meyerson came into the group in Cleveland in 1939, after with all this publicity, and he immediately tried to take the whole thing over, and we had a lot of problems with him at the beginning. But he, every place he'd go, he'd get in a hotel, he'd find some drunken salesman in there. He had a capacity. He couldn't sell this guy the idea himself, but he could sell the idea of that guy coming to Cleveland to see me. My God, the men he sent to Cleveland. And they came. So it was remarkable the things this fellow did. He started groups in Indianapolis and Jacksonville, even in Miami. Believe me, he got around. So one time, you know, he's the fellow that broke me into selling education. I went to work with Meyerson later on. We traveled together for quite a long time. And here's how Indianapolis got going. Indianapolis. I don't know if any people here from Indianapolis. Are you? Okay. Irv Meyerson is in Indianapolis, and he met Doherty Sheeran down there. Doherty was an Irishman, and here's this big Jew boy. And Doherty was an alcoholic, and he was fighting the battle by himself. He never heard of us, of AA or anything like that. And he was dry just on guts alone, that's all. He was having a miserable life. Doherty was a swell fellow, a real gentleman. And Irv met Doherty and talked AA to him and got him the book. And Doherty got really excited about this stuff. And through he and Doherty, they got the Indianapolis group started. I was with Irv one time. We worked in Indianapolis for a couple of weeks there. And Doherty called one night. He said he had a fellow he wanted us to come down and talk to. So we went over to see Doherty. And who did he have there? He had a drunken priest. I have never seen anybody in any worse shape than this fellow, believe me. He was all pilled up and bruised up, and he didn't know if he was in Indianapolis or Indochina. And we sat there and talked to that bird practically all night. I don't think he even knew we were there. That happened to be Father Fow. A lot of you folks have known of Father Fow. He had a lot of writings that have been very good. Whatever you might have thought of Father Fow, he was kind of a controversial character, but he did a lot of good for a lot of people. But that was how we found poor Father Fow. So Irv was the fellow that was responsible for many, many groups around. People left from Cleveland and went to California. The first person was this Mrs. Miller, left Cleveland. It was the first one that went to California with this plan of ours. Now, I told you about different people and what they did and how they got organized and how this AA started. You think it was all easy and all simple, you're crazy. Because we had no backing. We had no good press like we have now. Everything was a struggle. We had to forge our way through things. To get into hospitals was a major miracle, to have a hospital even cooperate with us. I worked with social workers. They gave me some good prospects. I want you to always remember this is a sales job. This is not anything attraction at all. And when we start to let the other poor old rummy out here, like this man explained to us, our speaker last night, they don't have what it takes to come to us. We have to go to them. We have to carry that message. Now, let me tell you about carrying a message to the extreme. I had a social worker, a Miss Mooney. She was a big Irish gal, and she used to wear tailored suits and flat-heeled shoes. She wore men's shoes, I think they looked like it. And she sent me several good rummy prospects that were people she was taking care of in her social work. So one day Mooney gets a hold of me. She has a gal she wants me to fix. And she told me something about this gal. This gal had come from a very wealthy family. She broke her family, I guess. She broke up her uncle's home when she was about 13 years old with a little pitter-patty with her uncle. She got off to a good start. And this girl was living in a colored neighborhood with some Italian bootleggers. This is where she was living. And Catherine did not work. She was on the dole. There was some relief people were taking care of her. And Catherine would do anything for a drink, and I mean anything. There was nothing. I have never in my life, before or since, have I seen a girl who has fallen to the depths of degradation that Catherine was in. That's standard. I've never seen anything like it. And this is a gal that Mooney introduced me to. I'm supposed to fix her. She hasn't been sober for God knows when, you know? So I take on the challenge, of course. You take on everybody. And I thought I was getting along pretty well with Catherine. But wasn't too long, though. One day, going home at noontime, I used to get away from the place where I was working. I was selling cars, and I'd go home and lay out for a little while and rest. I'd walk down the drugstore, I guess, to get something. Here comes Catherine down the street. And Catherine is so drunk she can't hit the ground with her hat. So Catherine's been out to the Warrensville workhouse so many times that she was serving a life sentence on the installment plan. And she knew every brick on the way out there. And I grab a hold of Catherine and says, "Catherine, let's get out of here. Get off this street. You're going to get picked up. You'll be back there at Warrensville again." "Okay." So I start taking her home. She lived a couple blocks away from me. Lived over at Cedar Avenue. Bad section then. But Catherine decided before she went home she wanted something to eat. Well, she made a big hullabaloo about this. You'd have to know Catherine to know why I caved in and give in to her. She was very persuasive. She had language the likes of which I've never heard any place. I think Catherine used to teach sailors how to swear. In fact, I think she made up words. She was something else, no kidding. And she was young. She's in her early 30s at the time. And she's skinny as a match. And so Catherine wants something to eat. So I try to take her into this Greek joint on 81st and Euclid there. And she looks at me and she says, "I wouldn't go in a dump like that. I want a place with a tablecloth. I'm used to eating like a lady." There you are, a lady. She's so drunk she can't find her mouth. Well, she's raising a lot of hell and I want to get her off the street. So to humor her, I made my first big mistake. I took her down the street to 79th and Euclid, where that nice spaghetti house is down there, that Italian restaurant. And all the business and professional people around there eat there at noon, and it's a quiet place. They have a carpet on the floor and there's tablecloths and male waiters with tuxedos. And as soon as I brought Catherine in there, I knew that I had done the wrong thing. She is dirty, she stinks, she's loud, and she is profane. And we go over and sit down at this table, and she right away has a tete-a-tete with the waiter. They're having trouble already. And she's telling him a few things about his ancestors. So everyone can hear it, you know, the people are stopping, looking over there. And the next thing you know, she orders. She ordered spaghetti. But she has about as much chance of eating that spaghetti as I have flying to the moon, see? But the spaghetti came. And in the meantime, the head waiter had come around and tried to shush her, and she don't like him at all. I think she had something against his rule of authority. And this fellow, the head waiter, he was authority in her book. So she told him a few things, too, that she hadn't told this other guy. Well, she's still making an awful fuss and racket, and she starts working on the spaghetti. Coming up here, and she's got it all over her. Get it on her. She got a little in her. It's all over her. And it's dropping back down in the plate. And this waiter, this head waiter, come back again, and he was giving her the word real good. And she'd had enough of him. She wanted no more of this guy at all. She'd gone her limit with him. So this little guy wouldn't do anything but pick up this plate of spaghetti and throw it all over this head waiter, right down his dicky. Well, it was about 2 minutes the wagon was there. And Catherine and I are both in the wagon. We get down to that police station, and they put me in one coupe over here, and they took her someplace else. And I'm rattling those bars and telling them I don't belong here. It's just a mistake. The guy says, no, no one belongs here. This place is full of mistakes. So I get this treatment. I get no place. And I guess at 3 o'clock they change shifts. And another bunch of keepers come in about that time. And I start my rattling situation all over again. And one guy finally listened to me. I says, you call Crowley, the probation officer. Ed will tell you all about me, and he'll tell you that I don't belong here. The guy says, you know Crowley? I said, yes, call him, for God's sake. Get me out of this place. And he did, and Crowley thought this was great. This was the funniest thing that ever happened to him. But he got me out, but they kept Catherine, and they sent her out to the slammer again. Well, I didn't see anything of Catherine for some time, so one day I'm home again walking down the drugstore. I should stay out of the drugstore. And here comes Catherine again. If anything, she's worse shape than she was the first time I saw her. She just got out of the coop and she's all drunk up again. So I said, Catherine, you'll be back in Wandsville by this afternoon. Let's get off the street. Let's go home. But I said, Catherine, we don't eat today. So, okay, so we got the 82nd and Euclid. As you know, there's a Jewish temple on one corner and a Unitarian church on the other here. There's a traffic light there. So I thought I'd cross at the traffic light. I didn't want to risk trying to get her across the street where there wasn't any light because she was pretty unsteady. So we get to this light and we're waiting for the light to change. And here's high noon and all these business people are off heading for their lunch again. The street's full of people, and Catherine feels the call of nature. And she don't do one damn thing but squat right there on 82nd and Euclid, and I'm standing there holding her by the hand. I tell you, this is something to be said for sponsorship. Well, don't you know, some of these interested passers-by stopped and they looked, and they had a few words, and she had some words for them, too. And don't you know, it wasn't another minute or so till I wagon her again. Right back to 21st and Central was right, away we went. Well, indecent exposure, oh, I don't know what all they had, but they had us, see. And intoxication, of course, they assume that I'm in the same shape. Why would I be with her? And back I go. Start all that stuff all over again.
Crawley had to get me out the second time. He thought this was really rich that time. This is entertainment by now. I didn't think it was so funny. I do now, but it's looking back on it. But you know, what did we do to that girl? Between Mooney, Miss Mooney, Crawley, and myself, we arranged to put her in Warrensville for a year. Put her in jail for one solid year. A year and a day she got as a habitual. Now that's taking a lot of for granted when you take your freedom away for a year. I told them that the only way we're ever going to do anything with Catherine is she's going to have to get completely reorganized. We're going to have to get her well and sober and get some meat on her bones and everything else. So she couldn't, I didn't see how they could do anything but give her a year. And they did. But they're out there for a year. Well, of course, I didn't dare go out and see her right then because she knew I had a hand in this. But I knew she'd send for me eventually, which she did. So when I went out, she sent for me, and I knew the matron out there, and she called me and said, Captain wants to see me. I went down to the dime store, and I bought her some little stink water the girls like in the dime store. And I bought her some cigarettes and some I think I a little candy and stuff like that. I spent about 60 cents on this broad. This was the really plunging, and I had it all in a bag. So I went out to Warrensville to see her, and I'm sure glad they had that screen up out there. Because when I came in there, boy, I heard something. The air was blue. And the only thing I could stand in the way she got through, eventually she ran out of gas, and all she wants to do is get out of there. I told her, Captain, you're not getting out of here. You've got a year and a day, and you're going to be here all that time. So make up your mind to it. That's the end of it. You're going to be here. They put her in the hospital out there. I can assume that Catherine had everything from dandruff to fallen arches with the kind of a life she was living and the things that she was exposed to. So they kept her in the hospital. They started building her up. She started getting some fat on her bones. After she quit hollering at me that day, I gave her my bag of goodies and she accepted them. I went out to see Catherine every week, sometimes two, three times, sometimes twice a week I'd go see her. But she quit yapping about getting out after a while. She resigned herself to it. When she came out of there a year later, Miss Mooney took her out of that neighborhood and got her a room with some old people way out by Yucca Beach Park. And these are some Slovenian people. They knew nothing about her. They never heard of her, knew nothing about drunks. And she went to work out, she went out there to live. And I tried to bring her to a meeting and they threw her out. The women would not accept her in the AA meeting. And so she couldn't go to AA. But I took her to some picnics and things where we had a big bunch of people or she didn't have any identity. But she couldn't get into the AA way of doing things. But she did one thing very important. She went back to her church. She was a Catholic, and she went back into her church. She hadn't been there for a long time, and she was interested in working with kids, and she was very good at working with kids. When we came out of there, Mooney got her a job in one of the hotels, first on a bathing beach as a lifeguard. She could swim like a fish. When the bathing beach closed in the fall, Mooney got her in a hotel as a floor clerk. And Catherine went back to school and started getting a refresher course on her typing and shorthand and things like that. And don't you know, she finally got a job as a stenographer. She became a private secretary. She wouldn't spend a dime to see the original crucifixion. She's the tightest babe I ever saw in my life. She saved all her money. These are stories. I'm going to write a book on a lot of these people. They're terrific stories of what happened to their lives. I have notes here of an awful lot of them here I could mention here, but it'd take too long. I don't have the time. But I just wanted to give you an idea how things were in what they call the good old days. Those good old days weren't all good. There was a lot of problems and a lot of things we had to overcome. There were some tragic things happened in those days, too. The hospitals wouldn't take people, and I had one fellow die on account of that. They thought he was drunk, and he wasn't. He'd been hauled into one of these hospitals on numerous occasions before, and the East Cleveland police called me one day and told me they had this fellow in the in their garage. They left him lay on the floor of the paddy wagon. They picked him up on the street. He was unconscious. They took him to the hospital. The hospital people there recognized him as a drunk. And they said, he's drunk, we get him the hell out of here. So take him back to jail. The police didn't put him in jail. They knew something was wrong with this fellow. But they called me, and I went out and took him over to the Post Shaker. And the man had had a cerebral hemorrhage. But because of his history of being a rummy, going into this place, this emergency room, they wouldn't take him and he died. If they'd have known about the cerebral hemorrhage, maybe they could have done some massaging or something and maybe saved his life. This is one of the tragedies. I've seen a lot of tragedy in those days, but there's a lot of great stuff too. So you have to take the bitter with a sweet. I let people commit suicide right in my face in this thing, right there in that boarding house too. Oh brother, I don't want to talk about those things, but those things happen, but you look at the great things that have happened, the thousands of people who have been affected by this and the wonderful things that have happened in their lives. I had one of the greatest